This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا مِنْهُ لئن أذقناه نعماء بعد ضراء مسته ليقولن ذهب السيئات عني إنه لفرح فخور إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير. صدق الله العلي.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely, he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good. They shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Our headlines: Israeli forces kill a Palestinian teenager during an attack on a refugee camp near the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. The UN Children's Agency says one child dies every 10 minutes from preventable causes in Yemen. Also, the leader of Afghanistan's resistance movement says he's ready for war as the Taliban surround the defiant Panjshir Valley. Thank you for joining us. Beginning with our top story, Israeli forces have killed a teenage Palestinian boy during an attack on a refugee camp in the northern occupied West Bank. Ahmad Hashash was shot dead during clashes between Israeli forces and Palestinians in Balata refugee camp near Nablus. Troops attacked the camp in the early hours of Tuesday. Israeli soldiers frequently carry out overnight raids on Palestinian neighborhoods in the occupied West Bank. The raids often trigger protests by Palestinian residents and result in clashes with regime forces. In one such incident earlier this month, four Palestinian men were fatally shot in the Jenin refugee camp, also in the north of the West Bank. Tensions have run high across the occupied territories in recent months. Palestinians are outraged at Israel's settlement expansion and its crackdown on worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, gave us some details on the Israeli forces' fatal shooting of the Palestinian teen near Nablus. Here's more.
What happened is that early Tuesday, the Israeli forces raided the refugee camp of Balata, east Nablus, northern occupied West Bank, and of course the Palestinian youths left their homes trying to prevent the Israeli forces with their armored vehicles from storming Balata refugee camp. The clashes erupted. The Israeli soldiers used live fire against the protesters and the Palestinian youths, killing 16-year-old Ahmad Hashash from the refugee camp of Balata. It's not the first time we have seen the majority of the major raids to the Palestinian areas, the Israeli forces using excessive force against the Palestinians. It's not an issue of detaining Palestinians who are said that they are wanted for security reasons, according to the Israeli military. Experts are saying that it's unacceptable when the Israeli forces use excessive force against unarmed Palestinians, civilians, the real owners of the land, just to show how strong they are and just to keep reminding the Palestinians that they are living under the Israeli occupation.
Israeli warplanes have carried out a series of fresh airstrikes against different locations across the besieged Gaza Strip. Earlier, we were joined by our Gaza correspondent, who gave us more details about the latest Israeli attacks.
After the breaking news just minutes ago, Israeli fighter jets attacked two other locations in the besieged enclave. The latest one was in the east of Gaza City, Zaytun neighborhood. They targeted farmland there, causing damage to agricultural areas. And they also attacked south of Gaza City. And earlier, as regarding the breaking news, that was five attacks on a Hamas security training center west of the southern Gaza Strip town of Khan Yunis, causing extensive damage to that place and also to surrounding areas. Over the last few days, the Israeli regime has been attacking the Gaza Strip using drones, F-35 fighter jets and F-16 fighter jets to target Hamas security posts, because the Israeli regime blames Hamas for the peaceful protests that took place on Friday, marking the desecration of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the 52nd anniversary of the desecration of Al-Aqsa Mosque by an Australian Zionist extremist.
At least one civilian has been killed in Saudi Arabia's shelling of a border region of Yemen's Sa'dah province. Yemeni media say another Yemeni civilian was injured in the Saudi attack. Saudi Arabia launched its war on Yemen in March 2015. Tens of thousands of Yemenis, many of them women and children, have been killed. Riyadh is still defying calls by the UN and rights groups to bring a halt to its cross-border aerial and ground attacks on the impoverished nation. The UN Under Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator has warned that 5 million Yemenis are one step away from famine. Martin Griffiths called for increasing aid from donors to avert famine in Yemen. He added that more than 20 million people in the impoverished nation need humanitarian assistance. Meanwhile, UNICEF Executive Director Henrietta Fore said one Yemeni child dies every 10 minutes from preventable causes, including malnutrition and vaccine-preventable diseases. The UN has already said Yemen is experiencing the world's worst humanitarian crisis that has been caused by the years-long Saudi-led war and blockade on the country. International human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan believes the US and the UK have thrown their weight behind the Saudi war on Yemen despite the humanitarian crisis there. Let's take a listen.
So the British and even the American are looking for, you know, new places to wage war and to continue to fund its war machine. But the West, United Nations, the rich countries are actually not even turning a deaf ear, but actually are supporting the aggressors and the Saudis here, who have, you know, there's like over 20 million people on the verge of starvation. One child dying every 10 minutes. You've got millions on the verge of dying. And this is, you know, cruel, but it's a man-made crisis. There is, you know, no benefit other than that. I think the Saudis don't want to see a Shia government in Yemen, or a government that deals with the popular interests and looks after the people, as opposed to just, you know, the elite that is supported by the Saudis. So, you know, it's maybe that is the reason why this, the P5 people of Saudi Arabia, the government there, is so opposed to Yemen being an independent state.
The leader of the Afghan National Resistance Front has rejected the idea of handing over Panjshir province to the Taliban. Ahmad Massoud said he hopes to resolve the issue through negotiations. He added if the talks fail, his resistance forces are ready to fight. The Taliban have increased its forces near Panjshir province. The group says the forces have cut off entrances to the area and are on high alert. Reports, however, say the public uprising forces have disrupted the Taliban siege. The Taliban have retaken three districts in northern Afghanistan that fell to local militia groups last week. Except for one, all 34 Afghan provinces are currently under Taliban control. An operation by U.S.-led foreign forces to pull out of Afghanistan is underway as the withdrawal deadline of August 31st looms. A NATO official says the evacuation is being conducted on a, quote, war footing at Kabul airport. The Taliban have warned the U.S. of consequences if the deadline is not met. The U.S. military has advised President Joe Biden to decide soon whether to extend the process beyond August 31st. Advisors have told the White House that the decision must be made by Tuesday to have enough time to pull out around 6,000 American personnel. Biden has already cautioned that American troops might stay beyond the deadline. 1 week after the fall of Kabul to the Taliban, the city's main airport is still the scene of chaos, with thousands of people rushing to Kabul International Airport to flee the country. The chaos has left tens of people, including women and children, dead. Namin Alami reports.
The situation in the Afghan capital, Kabul, is getting worse as a big chaos is ongoing in and around Kabul International Airport.
Just a few hundred meters behind me, there is Kabul International Airport, and thousands of people have gathered here to take a flight and flee the country. But both the Taliban and American forces who are stationed here do not allow the people to enter.
Thousands of Afghans rushed to Kabul International Airport only a day after Taliban took control of the capital, Kabul, almost a week ago.
This is a tragedy for every single Afghan national. The U.S. claims that it has spent $1 trillion in Afghanistan. No, they were not after making good governance system in our country. They were only after imposing the current situation on our people and Afghanistan.
Chaos in Kabul airport has so far resulted in the death of at least 20 Afghans, including women and children. The horrifying situation in and around Kabul International Airport has created a big chaos.
People had heard something about the evacuation of Afghan nationals by the U.S. and other foreign troops from Kabul International Airport. So thousands of them gathered around the airport to get into it. But it was just a rumor because even many passport holders couldn't get into the airport.
This comes as the Taliban blamed the U.S. forces for failing to bring the situation under control in the airport, an issue that, according to the Taliban, has led to the loss of civilian lives. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Well, the sudden and chaotic withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan has generated concern among U.S. allies around the world. For South Korea, it also shows that its war plan with the U.S. to invade the North when it becomes unstable is unworkable. Frank Smith reports from Seoul.
The hasty and chaotic U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan has rattled the idea that the South Korea-U.S. alliance is as, quote, ironclad, as diplomats say. Analysts suggest that the presence of U.S. forces here in South Korea serves U.S. interests, both in terms of deterring North Korea and for checking the expansion of China's influence. But those U.S. interests didn't prevent former U.S. President Donald Trump from threatening to remove U.S. forces from South Korea to force Seoul to pay more for hosting U.S. troops. South Korea has hosted tens of thousands of U.S. troops on dozens of bases throughout the country since the 1950 to 53 Korean War. As a U.S. ally, Seoul is expected to participate in U.S. missions abroad. Security policy analyst Itae Ho argues South Korea's automatic participation in U.S. conflicts is unjustified.
The National Assembly's approval to dispatching troops to Afghanistan and Iraq indicates that South Korea participates in such wars to support American counterterrorism warfare. And unfortunately, the Korean government does not provide any official evaluation afterward.
For South Korea, the U.S. failure in Afghanistan provides lessons to the South Korea-U.S. alliance and its strategy of entering and occupying North Korea, if and when Pyongyang is no longer in control.
Even though military forces from all over the world took part, it only showed that taking one country by force is not sustainable. For us, it implies that the current military plan between South Korea and U.S. of invading North Korea when it becomes unstable is in fact unrealistic.
He also suggests the South Korea case is different from Afghanistan, as this country has its own advanced military to deter North Korea, although more emphasis needs to be given to negotiations with Pyongyang. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Iran's parliament is debating the proposed cabinet lineup of President Ebrahim Raisi for a fourth day. Lawmakers are reviewing the qualifications of four picks on Raisi's list for ministerial posts. They have so far discussed 11 out of 19 nominees. Supporters and opponents of the candidates are given the stage to speak for or against them. The proposed ministers will also have the chance to present their plans and defend themselves. The four remaining ones will be discussed on Wednesday when a vote of confidence is set to take place. The Iranian president will have up to 3 months to name a replacement if any of the proposed ministers fails to win the vote. Raisi has said his lineup is meant to bring about justice and progress. The leader of Tunisia's largest political party, Ennahda, has dismissed the members of the executive board. Rachid Ghannouchi says he's seeking reforms within the party. The move comes as President Kais Saied extended the suspension of parliament until further notice. Our correspondent in the capital, Tunis, Amir Bouka, joined us earlier with an update on this story. Here's more.
The head of the Political Crisis Management Committee in the Ennahda party, Mr. Mohamed Al-Khomani, said that the movement received angry messages from Tunisians and that the movement extracted mistakes from the past. He said that Tunisia will not go back before the 25th of July. He noted also that Ennahda desires to resume the normal democratic path and to benefit from the mistakes of the past and from the requirements of the new FAS. So a meeting expected maybe between the President Kais Saied and the head of Ennahda movement, Rashid Ghannouchi, in the coming days. Because the action or the statement that Ennahda published today to exempt all the members of the executive office and to reform it in order to respond to the requirements is something weird, to be honest with you. No one expected Rashid Ghannouchi to take this action.
Anti-vaccination protesters in the UK have gathered around the building of one of the country's largest television news outlets to show their anger at the British media bias. The protest was held at a headquarters of the news broadcaster ITN in central London. The protesters said the mainstream media are not reporting on what they claim are the adverse effects of COVID-19 vaccines. At one point, a number of demonstrators entered the lobby of ITN building, but police forcibly removed them from there. The ITN said the abuse of journalists because of the reporting on the coronavirus is a worrying development. Britain has been one of the worst-hit European countries by the virus, with a record of over 131,000 deaths. Health officials say the country's vaccination program has saved around 95,000 lives. Well, that's your war news for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
the supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
In the limelight.
As people all over the world acknowledge the Epic of Ashura as the most inspirational event for achieving the cherished goal of building a global society on the basis of social justice and free of biological, chemical, and nuclear threats posed by Lucifer's sadistic hordes such as the Zionists, the U.S. regime, and the terrorists of all hue and color it sponsors, the immortal martyr of Karbala, true to his grandfather's prophetic words, indeed, stands out as the Ark of Salvation. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Kahan International. This article is published under the heading In Quest of Free Conscience to Save World. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. If you don't have religion, at least have a free conscience in your worldly affairs, is one of the famous statements of the person who stands as a supreme symbol of sacrifice to make humanitarian values immortal, and whose martyrdom we in Iran and the conscientious people throughout the world marked during the first 10 days of Muharram with the life-inspiring ceremonies climaxing on Ashura, or the 10th of the month of Muharram. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, who made truth triumph over falsehood over a millennium, 3 centuries and 82 lunar years ago on the plain of Karbala in what is now Iraq, needs no introduction. His universal message for the salvation of human societies from the tentacles of tyrants has long been internationalized and knows no borders, whether natural in the form of such geographical features as mountains and seas, or man-made, like the imaginary lines drawn across regional and world maps to indicate boundaries of nation-states. It also cuts across pandemics such as COVID-19 produced by devils in human form, or more properly modern-day Yazids, as field tests to gauge the deadly effect of biological warfare on the wrong assumption that any opposition to the hegemony of global dictators would be crushed, just as the Umayyads' slaughter of almost all male members of Prophet Muhammad's progeny at Karbala. The blood of the Prophet's grandson triumphed over naked swords, because his uprising was not suicidal, but an accurately planned resistance and battle against heavy odds that has served as a catalyst for reforms and revolutions in every age and place. Likewise, this year's and last year's observance of the rituals of Muharram, with due regard for the medical protocol, including hygienic measures, for the scores of millions of devotees all over the globe, is firm indication of the willpower, coupled with scientific measures, to immunize humanity against the satanic efforts of the makers of the coronavirus. If the online or virtual ceremonies commemorating the heartrending tragedy of Karbala, along with the physical presence of mourners at the mosques or Husseiniyas, of course with due social distancing, sanitary measures and the use of masks, are an indication of the spirit of resistance, the dedicated research of scientists at labs for finding the most effective antidote, coupled with the vaccination campaign, are further proofs of the Iranian nation's firm faith in the philosophy of Imam Hussein's movement in holding out the torch of guidance for human societies in their quest for peace and justice. The Islamic Republic of Iran thus needs to mobilize all its resources for not just securing Iran against every kind of threat, but for continuing its humanitarian efforts for helping the people of the region and beyond overcome crises created by the hegemons to destabilize countries. In short, as people all over the world, not necessarily Muslims, acknowledge the Epic of Ashura as the most inspirational event for achieving the cherished goal of building a global society on the basis of social justice and free of biological, chemical, and nuclear threats posed by Lucifer's sadistic hordes, such as the Zionists, the US regime, and the terrorists of all hue and color it sponsors, the immortal martyr of Karbala, true to his grandfather's prophetic words, indeed stands out as the Ark of Salvation.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Years ago, the first democratically elected government in the Middle East and West Asia was overthrown in an Anglo-American coup plot. The victim was Mohammad Mossadegh, the champion of the nationalization of the oil industry in Iran. Operation Ajax, as the plot was codenamed by the Americans, and Operation Boot, as it is referred to by the British, reshaped the history of Iran, the Middle East, and even the world. It restored Mohammad Reza Shah to the peacock throne, a luxury with an iron fist, eventually sparked the Islamic Revolution of 1979 in Iran. On March 15, 1951, legislation to nationalize the Iranian industry was passed by the Majlis. Spearheaded by Dr. Mossadegh, the courageous move won him huge popularity among the masses, but at the same time earned him British enmity. Britain, which did not want to lose its privileges regarding the Iranian oil fields, built up diplomatic pressure, asked the UN to intervene, and in the end tried to threaten the Iranian government by sending the British Navy to the Persian Gulf against Mossadegh, who assumed power in the Prime Minister's office a month later. Despite all this, Mossadegh emerged triumphant from the 1952 parliamentary elections and used the victory to intensify anti-Shah and anti-British rhetoric. Iranian oil was an existential priority for the United Kingdom. The Iranian refinery of the Anglo-Iran Oil Company, AIOC, which would later become British Petroleum, BP, was the world's largest refinery. Depending largely on Iranian resources, the company was the world's second largest crude oil exporter, with the third largest reserves under its control. Perhaps an even more important fact, the company alone met the British Navy's 85% fuel needs. Unable to take the Iranian Prime Minister under control, Britain sought America's blessing to act against Mossadegh's government. But President Harry Truman explicitly rejected such British proposals. The elections in the United States, however, came to Britain's aid. Shortly after Dwight Eisenhower's election in November 1952, Britain sent agents to Washington and persuaded the new president's team to orchestrate the coup. For this purpose, Kermit Roosevelt, the Middle East director of the CIA, arrived in Tehran in June 1953 and began bribing a significant number of politicians and journalists to destroy Mossadegh's popularity and create chaos in Iran as a precursor of the coup. The demonization of Mossadegh began through fabrications and slanders, a systematic effort to influence public opinion against the politician who stood outside the orbit of the West.
The US and Britain had the same level of involvement in carrying out the coup. As much as $5 million were spent buying support from senior officials, military officers, newspaper editors and thugs to carry out the Western-backed plot to overthrow the democratically elected Prime Minister Mossadegh.
At the same time, Britain launched an economic war against Iran along with an international propaganda campaign. London also froze Iran's assets in Britain, forbade exports of oil drilling equipment to Iran. The British also started threatening potential customers interested in Iranian oil. The US, on the other hand, cancelled a previously promised $25 million loan to Iran. The circle around Mossadegh began to narrow as the markets and ordinary traders began to feel the pinch of the economic crisis. It was then that Churchill and Eisenhower officially ratified the coup plan in early July. They made the Shah issue an order for the dismissal of Mossadegh from his post, even though it was against the constitution. After a failed coup attempt on August 15th, which led to the escape of Mohammad Reza Shah abroad, the second attempt on August 19th caught the Iranian Prime Minister off guard. The crowd on the CIA's payroll seized the streets, while pro-Shah forces besieged Mossadegh's residence and captured him after 9 hours of fighting. Mossadegh was tried in a military court, served 3 years in prison, and died under house arrest in 1967.
As a result of this coup, Mohammad Mossadegh was arrested, tried, and convicted of treason by the Shah's military court. This is the tip of the iceberg that shows and reveals the expansionist policies of the hegemonic powers in the world.
The monarchy, restored under the pro-Western Shah and Anglo-Iranian Oil, renamed British Petroleum, tried to get its fields back, though it could return to the conditions prior to the nationalization of oil. The effects of the coup were far more profound than those planned by the coup plotters. Kinzer, in his book All the Shah's Men, writes, "A significant factor behind the public anger toward the US during the Islamic Revolution was the role played by Washington in the 1953 coup. The coup, an imperialistic response to the nationalization of oil, is still regarded as the root cause of distrust between Iran and the US. After almost 7 decades after the coup, the Iranian nation is still cynical about the Americans' intentions at the highest levels. In the words of former CIA operator Robert Baer, Iranians truly believe that if it weren't for the CIA, the Shah would never have been brought to power, and they believe that the CIA continues to operate as an evil force in their country. American and British involvement in Mossadegh's ouster was long public knowledge, but neither the Americans nor the British formally acknowledged their roles until 64 years later. On August 19, 2013, the CIA publicly admitted for the first time its involvement in the 1953 coup. Denied by Britain until 2020, the coup exposes the machinations of the Western powers to dispose popular civilian politicians while backing repressive rulers like the Shah of Iran whenever their interests require it. Last year, a discovered transcript of an interview with a British intelligence officer indicated that Britain was the driving force behind the overthrow of Mossadegh. In his account, Norman Derbyshire said Britain had convinced the US to take part in the coup. A part of the transcript reads, "The plan would have involved seizure of key points in the city by what units we thought were loyal to the Shah, seizure of the radio station, etc., the classical plan." The 1953 coup dashed all the hopes of a nation that yearned for a democratic government during the tyranny of Mohammad Reza Shah and poisoned the relationship between Iran and the US in the following decades. Iran's deep distrust of the US is firmly founded on what the Americans did on August 19, 1953.
The Taliban are now in effective control of billions of dollars in U.S. weaponry, from thousands of grenades and machine guns to Black Hawk helicopters. American forces poured into Afghanistan over the past two decades. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Andrea Germanus Ryder. This article is published under the heading, "Adding to U.S. failures in Afghanistan, Taliban have grabbed billions in weaponry." Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The Taliban are now in effective control of billions of dollars in U.S. weaponry, from thousands of grenades and machine guns to Black Hawk helicopters. American forces poured into Afghanistan over the past two decades. The equipment amassment follows months of surrenders by U.S.-backed Afghan security forces that failed to defend district centers, the Associated Press reported. AP said, bigger gains followed, including combat aircraft, when the Taliban rolled up provincial capitals and military bases with a stunning speed, topped by capturing the biggest prize, Kabul, over the weekend. Over the past 20 years of U.S. spending over $83 billion in weaponry and equipment for Afghan security forces, whose collapse was years in the making, as the Washington Post headline put it. As the Taliban gained further control over territory this summer, the group showed off the weapons they gained from government-backed forces who surrendered. And this week, reported Agence France-Presse, the Taliban social media is awash with videos of Taliban fighters seizing weapons, cash, the majority supplied by Western powers. The White House acknowledged the extremist group's weapons gains recently. We don't have a complete picture, obviously, of where every article of defense materials has gone, but certainly a fair amount of it has fallen into the hands of Taliban, White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan told reporters, adding, and obviously we don't have a sense that they are going to readily hand it over to us at the airport, unquote. And a Pentagon official declined to say what efforts were underway to stop further weapons gains. Asked by a reporter if the U.S. was taking any sort of steps to prevent aircraft or other military equipment from falling into the hands of the Taliban, Army Major General Hank Taylor responded, "I don't have the answer to that question." Elias Youssef, Deputy Director of the Center for International Policy Security Assistance Monitor, said the Taliban's weapons gains deserve scrutiny. He told The Hill, "Clearly, this is an indictment of the U.S. security cooperation enterprise broadly. It really should raise a lot of concerns about what is the wider enterprise that is going on every single day, whether that's in the West Asia region, Sub-Saharan Africa, or East Asia. The concern for all small arms is that they are durable goods and they can be transferred, sold," said Youssef, adding, "We have seen this before where a conflict ends and the arms that stay there make their way to all parts of the world." Also seized by Taliban, The Intercept reported recently, citing information from current and former U.S. military officials, are American military biometrics devices. These handheld interagency identity detection equipment, called HIDE devices, could have biographical information on Afghans who helped U.S. forces, and it's possible the Taliban could seek help from Pakistan's spy agency to process the data. The reporting on the weapons gains came the same week as the latest assessment from the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, SIGAR, the Congress-created watchdog. If the goal was to rebuild and leave behind a country that can sustain itself and pose little threat to U.S. national security interests, the overall picture is bleak, wrote John Sopko, the head of the agency. Among the key conclusions in the report was that the U.S. government did not understand the Afghan context and therefore failed to tailor its efforts accordingly, and that U.S. government agencies rarely conducted sufficient monitoring and evaluation to understand the impact of their efforts.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
on Youth Station. Youth Station. Youth Station. I am a Muslim. Islam my deen. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, boys and girls, other life forms. Welcome to today's episode of Youth Station. Thank you so very much for joining us here on IRB English Radio. I am your host, Zainab.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh. And I'm a co-host, brother Yasser.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you so much for being with us, bro. Often we are told this undeniable truth that crying for Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam washes away all sins. You know what? I ain't gonna argue with it. I ain't gonna dispute with it. I ain't gonna stand against it. I accept it as hardcore proof, because, at least for myself, because that's really what it's done for me. Crying for Imam al-Hussein has made me a better person, and it has motivated me to change my life for the better, so that I feel these tears I've shed for this man were genuine. They weren't just crocodile tears. I wasn't just being sentimental. I have something to show up for it, right? My actions. When we look at the history of Ashura, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, on the eve of Ashura, what did he tell his companions about debt? He said to them, if any of you... you're going to die tomorrow, basically. Let me be perfectly honest. Y'all are going to die tomorrow. If any of you owes any money to anyone, go pay off your debts. Dying in my company will do nothing for your haqq an-nas. And there's also this narration or this report that says Abu Abdullah reached Taf or Nainawa or Karbala or whatever, and he bought that area because he didn't want to die in usurped land. We would think that, but he's Imam al-Hussein. Does he need anyone's permission to die in that land? But he was like, no, man, not cool. And that is so scary, bro.
Besides Imam al-Hussein, this concept of haqq an-nas has, from the time of the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, till the other Imams, especially like, there's many traditions that I saw from Imam Ridha alayhi salam, talking about this. About, you know, haqq an-nas, the ability, the consequences of it, both in this world and in the hereafter. It's not funny. I don't know what the word. A humorous anecdote of one of the scholars. It's very beautiful, actually. It's very beautiful. One of the scholars gifted somebody a box of dates.
Okay.
And the person was confused that, why are you gifting me this box? And apparently it was quite expensive dates.
Right.
So he asked him, like, why are you giving this to me? He says, no, I heard that you had backbitten me. So on the day of judgment, you'll be giving me all your good deeds.
Oh, here's...
So here's my present for you.
The thought of haqq an-nas really makes my skin crawl.
And there's so much, and this, like, we don't know whether we've Look, one also important thing to realize when we say haqq an-nas, and this I spoke about this in one of my classes I gave a while back. It says nas. It doesn't say Muslim. It doesn't say mu'min.
Yes.
It says nas. It doesn't matter on a person's color, religion, race, language, nothing. Every single right that person has on you, you have to fulfill to the best of your ability. That requires two things. One, to know what rights that person has on you, and then to always to know how to perform it. So this is like...
It's scary. It's really scary because it's so intricate, you know? Sometimes we don't even know that we have abused someone's rights. And it's their rights. They don't want to forgive you for it. They don't want to turn a blind eye. They don't want to say, you know what, it's fine that you made my life miserable. And they have every right to do that and claim that from you on the day of judgment. And once that happens,
you can't get back.
You can't.
You can't.
And you know, scary talk aside, I think that's one of the things that makes the religion of Islam so beautiful and furthermore proves the fact that this is a religion of tolerance and peace and compassion and humanity, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, sometimes He forgives His own rights.
Yeah.
Right, out of ignorance or out of whatever reason, you don't fulfill some of Allah's rights, you know, as your Lord.
Mm.
And He's like, you know what, fine. My servant is ignorant, negligent. It's okay. I forgive them. But when it comes to the rights of His other servants, God is like, hell no. Mm. You stand here and you answer for what you did to my creation.
Mm.
And that shows that Islam is training us to mind other people.
Be very careful how you treat other people.
Yes.
How you speak to them. The manner you speak to them. The manner you look at them. The manner you think about them.
Because
that's also, okay, there may not be a sin, but it may count like...
It will influence, it'll
influence
your actions.
You, exactly, yeah. You know?
You're listening to Youth Station here on IRB English Radio. We're going to be back after a short break. Don't go anywhere.
Allah, Allah, Subhanallah, Allah.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. If you have any suggestion, our email is englishradio@irib.ir.
Thank you for joining us again. You're listening to Youth Station. I'm Zainab, and my co-host is Brother Yasser. When we look at the history of Ashura, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, on the eve of Ashura, what did he tell his companions about death?
There's so many riwayat that are coming to my mind now, and hadith about Hakkun Nas, especially when it comes to like sins, debt. Because those are the two main things. The one is debt, that you owe somebody money, you didn't pay it. And obviously in fiqh, this is discussed of how to go around it.
Intentionally didn't pay it.
You intentionally didn't pay it, or you had the ability to and you didn't, or you delayed when you could have, or you didn't seek that person's forgiveness. I mean, like one of the things, you know, that the family members on the day of a person's funeral has to ask is that, does this person have any more money?
Okay.
And if they do, please come to us, but with proof, obviously. If not, if there is... please forgive him. You know, one of the great deeds or great actions is to pay someone else's debt as well,
right.
If you have the ability
to figure them out.
And there's a lot of, you know, this whole system of debt, of borrowing and lending money, it's always beautiful that it is discussed in such great detail in Islam, but we don't actually realize why.
That is,
you know, because Allah doesn't want this Hakkun Nas
for you to carry it with yourself,
because there's so many different things that you can do to avoid it, to make sure it is not done. That's one issue, right? With money. The other one is backbiting, how you treat other
people.
That's
important.
The worst one is backbiting.
Ashaddu min az-zina. It's worse than adultery. And so, when we don't take that seriously, we honestly don't.
I mean, if you look at the higher levels of fiqh, the books of like Makasib of Sheikh Ansari, when he discusses this, it was like really frightening when I was reading this with my teacher, and I said like, there's so many times we don't even know we are backbiting somebody, but we are doing it.
Exactly.
The instances
are
difficult.
I think someone once asked Ayatollah Behjet about what are the instances of backbiting, and he said, whatever that person's not cool about you...
saying about
them. Yeah, saying about them. If that person is not cool with you mentioning their name in their absence, you don't get to do it. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is going to hold you accountable on the day of judgment, and He's going to be like, you had no right. You had no right to talk about my creation, my servant, that way. But again, it's important for us to raise awareness regarding this very, very important concept in Islam, which is haqqun nas, the rights of other human beings. And like Brother Yasser, as you beautifully mentioned, doesn't say haqqul muslimin or haqqul mu'mineen or haqqul whatever. It says people in general.
People in general.
All creations of God, all human beings. The point is, we first have to raise awareness about it. We have to understand that this is a real thing. It's a real deal. It's important for us to understand it. And then, once we do that, we can, inshallah ta'ala, help
ourselves not fall into the vortex of uncompensated haqq al-nas, right? Like our ulama and our hadith tell us to, on a daily basis, weekly, monthly basis, put aside a certain amount of money in case you have done something to someone somewhere, right? And give charity on their behalf. If you've done backbiting behind someone's back, first of all, go try to seek their forgiveness. If it doesn't stir up more conflict, or if you feel that it does, then give sadaqah on their behalf, repent on their behalf, pray for them, and promise God that you'll never do it again. Learn from your lesson. And it's all, at the end of the day, it's just all about growth. It's all about compassion. It's all about this beautiful hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, that if we just put it, set it as our life ethos, as our
motto.
Yes, our motto, treat others as you wish to be treated.
That is true. That is very true. And also, like you were mentioning it, like the scholars and the ulama, they would take a lot of care in the words. So when you know that there's such a thin line between doing something that is legal or illegal, to put it bluntly, you would take a lot of care in the words you would say.
Yeah, yeah.
The way you would treat people. You know, you this what concept of muraqibah, or this precaution that you would do, is also a form of self-building. So by doing it, you will be, you know, building yourself, enabling yourself to realize